This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening to Stateside. This show and this podcast are made possible with your support. $5 or $10 a month helps to pay for these conversations you listen to. So make your contribution right now at michiganradio.org or call 888-258-9866. It's our Spring Fun Drive on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All through this current session of the state legislature, Detroit Free Press Lansing reporter Kathy Gray has been tracking bills, what's pending, what's passed, and what Governor Snyder has signed. Well, let's take a look at the latter, the 16 bills that have been signed into law by the governor. Kathy's with us now from Lansing. Kathy, give us a sense of proportion here. We've got 16 bills signed into law, but how many more bills and resolutions were actually introduced in the House and Senate?
They're approaching 700 bills and more than 125 resolutions that they've already introduced this year. And the governor has signed 16 of those. So, you know, the legislative process takes kind of a long time.
I'm gathering, I'm thinking of hundreds of these getting introduced, and then the comparatively tiny number that actually trickle their way onto the gubernatorial desk.
Well, about 40% of the bills in the last legislative session ended up on the governor's desk. There was well over 1,000 bills that were introduced last legislative session. I think that they were approaching 1,500, and about 40% of those ended up becoming law.
Can you give us a quick rundown of the laws that have been signed, these 16 laws?
Sure. The first bill he signed, the first two bills he signed, set March 8, 2016 for the presidential primary next year, which is kind of interesting, seeing as all of a sudden he's been fueling rumors that he might run for president. We don't know if that's going to happen or not.
But you haven't seen that.
The first two bills. Yes, those were the first two bills that he signed. He also signed some bills regarding firearms, several bills regarding firearms. One would eliminate county gun licensing boards and transfer that authority to the Michigan State Police and to county clerks. He signed a bill that would give $24.7 million from the Natural Resources Trust Fund into different projects for recreation development in the state and for purchasing land for recreation in the state. He signed a bill that gives $3 million to autism programs at several universities around the state. And he has signed some budget bills, too, that, as you may recall, we all of a sudden came up with a $325 million shortfall in the budget this year because of business tax credits that were being cashed in by businesses that have been given out long ago. And so they passed some bills that made up for that difference, the $325 million hole. And last week, he signed some bills that prohibit people from using drones when they want to hunt, or using drones to harass hunters. So that's just, it's kind of a mishmash of bills.
It really does.
Signed into law so far.
In fact, I'm kind of wondering, are there any insights from all of this for what we might see going forward?
Well, right now we're deep into the budget season, and that's going to be taking up most of the air in the room in the Capitol for the next several weeks as the legislators, House and Senate, pass out budgets that are going to fund the state for the next year. So that's going to be the big thing. But some big things are coming up, too. Some adoption bills that would allow faith-based agencies to decide who they're going to and who they're not going to adopt to. Those are coming up for a final committee hearing this week. The big thing this week is major reforms to no-fault auto insurance. You know, there's a lot of things that are coming up, whether or not they make it to the governor's desk before they go on their summer break. That's another thing.
Is there anything that we can glean from all of this about the relationship between the governor and this legislature?
Well, there's definitely been some differences of opinion. The governor has come out and said that he would veto religious freedom bills if they came to his desk, which would allow businesses to refuse service to gay weddings for same-sex couples. So there's been that. There's been some differences on the budgets. And there's been some skepticism from Governor Snyder on these adoption bills that are coming to him. So we don't know if he'll sign those if it gets to him. So there's definitely been some differences that have been popping up between the governor and the legislature.
Detroit Free Press Lansing reporter Kathy Gray. Always good checking in with you from Lansing. Thank you so much, Kathy.
Thanks, Cindy.
This is Stateside on listener-supported Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty, and this is our spring fun drive. Getting tough on crime. For many people, that means get them off the streets, get them behind bars, and have parole boards be tough and demanding, slow to release an inmate. Filling prisons with criminals and being tough with sentencing and parole has led to this. Old, sick prisoners are the fastest-growing population in our prison system, and taxpayers are footing the growing health care bill. Steve Freese looked at this growing challenge for Al Jazeera America. His piece is titled Old Age in the Big House. Steve, good to have you with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nationally, why is it that we've seen this five-fold increase in lifers from 1984 to 2012?
The numbers are really shocking. And I've been hearing about all of these older people and the budget problem. This is a very big national problem. The data that I used was mostly about Michigan because I'm here and I happen to be able to get some access to the prison that has geriatric patients. But the reason is complicated, but primarily has to do with the tough on crime legislation that we pushed through as a country in the 80s and 90s. It has to do with mandatory minimums and life means life. And in this state in particular, in 1992, there was a sort of a Willie Horton moment for Michigan. There was a parolee who did some terrible stuff.
Leslie Allen Williams.
And it got a lot of attention and required a very stern response from the Michigan government. They revamped the parole board to turn it into a politically appointed body as opposed to a civil servant who may have more expertise and aren't as subjected to the political winds. They also changed the minimum amount of years that a lifer who is eligible for parole can apply for parole. So it used to be 10 years. Now it's 15 years. There are a couple of other things that have come up more recently as well. Inmates who have offended in some other way while they're in prison maybe got another sentence. But it's just a lot of different policy decisions that we as a country, as a community have made.
And what it looks like then, as you point out in your story for Al Jazeera America, you have a much older prison population. And as they get older, they get sicker. And what's that mean in terms of prison health care costs?
They've gone way, way up. In Michigan, they have tripled in the last few decades. Right now, the cost is about $300 million for just the health care costs. And that's 15% of the $2 billion that the state spends on corrections costs. And that is the single largest amount of money spent by Michigan on anything out of the general fund.
Yeah. In fact, we often note in Michigan that we pay more for corrections than we do on education in this state.
Yeah.
So this is a balancing act, isn't it? Punishing criminals, being tough on crime versus fiscal restraint.
It's so tricky. I mean, these are, or at least they have been, really bad guys, mostly guys. But there are also some issues with the women's prison as well. There's just a lot fewer of them. But when it comes to these men, these are guys who have raped and murdered and robbed and done a lot of terrible things. They have destroyed communities and they have destroyed families. Mm-hmm. And their punishment was to be put away for life. And that is what it sounds like, but also not what it sounds like. Because even 20, 30 years ago, life didn't mean life. It meant a certain bunch of years, maybe, you know, 15, 20, 30 years. I mean, I met six guys who combined for about 200 years of time served. And it's boggling. I mean, some of these people were in jail before I was born.
Hmm. You quote one advocate as saying most of the people who have aged in prison and who are seniors in prison certainly don't pose a risk to public safety. But there's that word most.
Right.
And no one wants to be the one to say yes to a parole and then open the door to any possibility of tragedy.
In, I think, 2009, Governor Granholm did a huge parole commutation sweep. I mean, she just let thousands of people out. And
overcrowded prisons.
They have some really interesting and very encouraging data on the recidivism rate. It wasn't very high. It was extremely low for these people. So there is some data. So what happens? You tell everybody, okay, this is how we're going to do it, and then something terrible happens, and then you tell that community, oh, but that's the statistical anomaly. And they're like, yeah, that doesn't help me.
An interesting piece by Steve Fries. It's on the expense and challenge of caring for the elderly sick prison inmates. You can find it at the Al Jazeera America website. It's called Old Age in the Big House. Thank you so much for being with us, Steve.
Thanks so much for having me.
Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. When we talk about climate change and what it's doing to our world, we often point to melting ice at the polar cap. We talk of rising sea levels and wonder what will happen to the animals that make their home in the Arctic. But there's something else happening. The permafrost is thawing, and wait till you hear what's being released in the atmosphere because of this. Henry Pollack is here again with us. He shares the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize for his work as an investigator and contributing author with the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And he is an emeritus professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan. And we always like to say, welcome to Stateside, Henry. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
How much of the Northern Hemisphere landmass is permafrost? Do we have any in Michigan?
We don't have any in Michigan. It extends partway south through Canada and partway south through Europe and Asia, where north of that those boundaries, we find a considerable area that's permafrost.
And by the name permafrost, we assume, yes, it's supposed to stay frozen, but?
Well, it does stay frozen, except for a small zone at the surface, which every summer gets a little mushy. But we call that the active zone, and just less than a meter down, it does stay frozen, except now with climate change, the warming is gradually penetrating into the permafrost and thawing it, and it's having a lot of interesting consequences.
Such as? What's being released as it thaws?
The first thing that's being released is the ice is thawing, and that leads to a change in volume because, as you know, ice is more volumetric than the equivalent water. So we're seeing subsidence, ponds developing where the thawing has taken place. And in these ponds, we're seeing a lot of bubbles rising out of the permafrost, which upon close analysis are methane and some carbon dioxide, both of which are greenhouse gases escaping into the atmosphere and augmenting the very climate change that has led to their release.
Just what we don't need, more methane and more carbon dioxide. Where's it coming from?
The methane is coming from biological activity in the soils and vegetation trapped in the permafrost. And as it thaws, it decays. And then when methane itself oxidizes, it oxidizes in part to carbon dioxide. So there you go.
Well, that strikes me as kind of like a freezer, and when our freezer breaks down, the stuff inside decays.
That's certainly right. We like to keep our freezer frozen, and in this case, we certainly don't want to let the ingredients escape into the atmosphere.
So is there anything that can stop this and put the brakes on it before the carbon dioxide and methane from this melting permafrost kind of accelerates things past our point of being able to put the brakes on?
I think that the process, while it is underway, is also a very slow process. And so some of the warnings of an imminent catastrophe, I think, are probably a little bit of hype. But nevertheless, there is no reversal in sight. And even though it's a slow unfolding thawing of the permafrost, it's kind of like watching grass grow, except it's in the opposite direction. We're watching the atmosphere warm and get more characteristics of a thermal blanket.
So as we're trying to do things to reduce these greenhouse gas emissions, the permafrost is giving off its own
That's right. That's right. So it's another what we call a positive feedback from the Arctic. The first being that as the Arctic loses its ice and its white color, it stops reflecting as much sunlight back into space and starts absorbing it in the open seawater and the rock. But in the case of the permafrost, it is also releasing this methane from deeper within the Earth where it's been trapped for quite a while.
Well, as you say, not to get too alarmist about it, but to be aware then, because I don't think that that idea of permafrost and any kind of thawing of the permafrost is on most people's radar screens.
Not as much as the direct loss of ice from Greenland and the diminishing amount of summer sea ice in the Arctic. But it's every bit as important, and it covers a huge area. And so in that context, it's something to keep your eye on. A lot more work is going on to measure these losses of the greenhouse gases to see if they're accelerating. We don't quite know whether this is a process that's been active for quite some time now and we're simply augmenting it or whether it's brand new. So there's a lot of work going on in the Arctic to spread out and observe the thawing permafrost and particularly measure the amounts of methane and carbon dioxide that's coming out.
Professor Henry Pollack, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Cindy.
Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and this is our Spring Fun Drive on Michigan Radio. Grindr is perhaps the best known of the location-based gay dating apps. Well, Matt Green's discovered Grindr is not only about looking for love or hookups, it can also be a place to find people searching for some sort of spiritual, even religious connection.
There is also a component that's very real of community organizing.
Matt Green comes from Ann Arbor. He's a second-year rabbinical student at New York City's Hebrew Union College, and he's become known as the Grindr Rabbi, using Grindr to reach out to gay Jews in New York City. Matt explains how GPS-enabled apps are changing the way people connect.
I mean, there's an idea that Grindr killed the gay bar, and the reason why is because gay men are on Grindr, finding each other on Grindr, and they don't need to go to a physical space to meet each other, and that reality, I think, is really important in terms of religious or cultural community organizing. That's a sort of principle that is real across the board, gay or straight or whatever, that people are using apps and are using technology to communicate in ways that are so far beyond the physical realm of what we were doing 30, 40 years ago.
So can you build spiritual ties through a dating app like Grindr? Matt takes us to the very beginning and explains how this idea came about.
Basically, I began rabbinical school last year in Israel, and when I came back from Israel, I downloaded Grindr and posted on my profile that I was becoming a rabbi. And so all of these people started reaching out to me about, what's that like? Can you be a gay rabbi? And then a million other questions after that, like, how do you keep kosher and so on? And basically, I had this idea that there had to be some way of bringing all of these people together. And essentially, that was the beginning of the project. My school at the beginning of this academic year mentioned that there was a program designed to inspire entrepreneurship and offer microgrants to pursue little projects. And I put the two together and I remembered this idea and the project was born.
And so I'm guessing there wasn't really any pushback from your teachers at Hebrew Union College. Was there any pushback when people began to realize kind of what the purpose of Grindr is?
Not really. I think that's been really interesting because I was pretty honest from the very start. I portrayed Grindr as the largest LGBT social network, which is true. And in addition to that, I fielded some questions about the sort of hookup nature of how Grindr is perceived. And people were a little bit skeptical, but in general, they were open-minded. I mean, the Reform movement of Judaism, which Hebrew Union College is a part of, is the biggest movement of Judaism, but it's also the mainstream liberal movement of Judaism. So in general, gay rights is pretty important to the movement.
I'm interested in the kinds of questions and what you're getting from the people who are reaching out to you. I'm wondering, is it to reconnect with their spiritual roots? Is it to build a social Jewish community, or all of the above?
I think on some level it is all of the above. I mean, I had a conversation with a conservative rabbi this weekend about it, actually. And he pointed out that people who are on Grindr are searching. They may be searching or looking for all kinds of different things, but one thing they are looking for is connection. And connection is assumed to mean a romantic or sexual connection, but realistically, it's also a communal or social connection. And so I think the spiritual piece is important, but it's also about using Grindr to create a community, to basically organize as a form of community organizing.
And you've begun hosting Sabbath dinners, haven't you? And those Friday evening dinners are truly the heart of Jewish life, aren't they?
Yeah, so that's been actually really fun and I think really important to what I'm trying to do more broadly. Those dinners, just to give you an image, are a group of 10 or 12 people coming together, most of whom who don't know each other, because I've met virtually all of them on Grindr, and maybe they've talked to one another on Grindr or seen one another's profiles, but in all likelihood, they don't know each other. And they come to my house, and we say the blessings for the wine and the challah bread, and then we continue on with a really spiritually uplifting dinner of kosher food in which we're together as Jews talking about things that matter to us as Jews and as gay Jews, which is, I think, is a really important void to fill.
Matt Green comes from Ann Arbor in East Lansing. He's a second-year rabbinical student at New York City's Hebrew Union College, and his nickname is the Grindr Rabbi, as he uses Grindr to reach out to Jews in New York and in Brooklyn. Matt, it was a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And it is time to talk wine with our Detroit's chief wine and restaurant critic, Chris Cook. Always good to have you with us, Chris, because you teach us good things. I always come away learning something after I've talked with you. Today we get to ask you about a puzzling tradition that I still see happening in some restaurants. We order a bottle of wine. It is brought to the table, and with it, the cork. What are we supposed to do with that thing? Sniff it? Do what with it? Look at it? What are we supposed to do with it?
Well, I don't think a lot of people know what to do with it. And there's both a history to it and several different answers. First of all, I've never understood what it is we're supposed to do with a cork either in today's market. But what you see people do is they pick it up, they sniff it, which isn't going to tell you much at all. I mean, it's not going to tell you if there's anything bad that's happened in the bottle particularly. I've never known anybody to sniff the cork and say, oh, my God, this wine has a big problem or anything like that. The one thing that you may be able to tell a little bit is if the cork is not soft, it may tell you something. And what it might tell you is that the bottle that was served has been standing up a long time, and therefore there's been no moisture contact between the wine and the cork, and maybe drying out a little bit. So you want to just factor that into your thinking when you actually taste the wine.
Would you drink the bottle if it's dry? Or what does it mean?
It may mean nothing.
Hmm.
But what it could be wrong with the bottle is that air may have seeped in there and you got sort of a degeneration of the wine is beginning to fall apart. So that's the main thing that you would be able to tell from that. The history behind it is sort of interesting, though, because this started in the 1800s because there had been a lot of fraud in wine in France. And what the winery started doing is they started marking all the corks with their name and then a date on either the top round part of the cork or the bottom. Usually it's on the top. when the restaurant would pull the cork out of the bottle, they could tell that, yes, this is a cork from, you know, Chateau so-and-so and Saint-Émilion, which is what my client wants with his dinner. Mm-hmm. So they'd put it in a little silver dish, bring it to the table, and present that dish so that the client could then pick up the cork and say, ah, yeah, it's verified. This is indeed the wine that I'm getting. Because the fraud at the time was they would copy labels of wineries, uh-huh, have them printed up, and just put corks in there and sell them as the original. We still have some of that problem going today on occasions.
Yeah.
So the cork then took on this kind of myth, this kind of snootiness that wound up in restaurant tradition. It's probably a good idea that you do see the cork, but, you know, generally you're going to see it anyway because most of the time they come to your table and uncork the wine there, and they'll just hand you the cork. But the ceremonial part doesn't really represent much today in terms of its purpose when it was started. Mm-hmm. And the silly little silver dish that they do in some restaurants, I can live without, frankly.
Also, I'm gathering if you see someone waving that cork under his nose and pronouncing the wine fine, we should assume this person is somewhat of a poser?
Well, yes. I mean, if they're looking for something like what's called TCA, which is actually cork taint, trichloral anisole is what TCA stands for, you're not going to find it by smelling the cork. You're going to find it by smelling the glass. That's the first point. You're going to smell that must. I've pulled corks out of bottles of wine suffering from volatile acidity or TCA and looked at that cork after I've tasted the wine and sniffed the cork. I can't tell anything in that cork that would have told me that that bottle had flaws in it that you would think would reside in the cork. That's the whole other subject. We call it cork taint, the trichloral anisole infection, but it really isn't simply from cork. It's from other things, too. So what you're going to get from sniffing the cork is absolutely minimal, in my view.
While we're talking corks, we really are seeing a move away in what is that synthetic cork that's being used when I'm pulling it out? It's a different feel. What is that stuff?
There's two things. There's the compound cork, where they grind up cork pieces and glue them together. There were initially problems when those came out, leaching some things from those kind of fabricated corks. But the newer ones are made from an oil base, I believe, and they're very good. The interesting thing is sometimes at some point people have pulled the cork out of those, poured the wine, and they smell cork taint, which would tell you that the cork didn't do it because this thing can't leach that TCA stuff.
Yeah.
And TCA can be picked up in the winery. It can be picked up outside the winery from the science that's been done, that it very often starts in the fields and on the grapes and is brought in. And it's a very rampant thing. But the poor old cork took the hit for it.
There you go. Chris Cook, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Chris Cook is the chief wine and restaurant critic for Our Detroit Magazine. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening to Stateside. This show and this podcast are made possible with your support. $5 or $10 a month helps to pay for these conversations you listen to. So make your contribution right now at michiganradio.org or call 888-258-9866.